From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
Whether you have a fancy, you know, title on your business card, or you have $1 million in the bank or $1 billion in the bank, the human instinct, I don't think, is actually that different. People want more.
That's Andrew Ross Sorkin. He's a columnist for the New York Times, where he serves as the editor-at-large of Dealbook, the daily financial report he founded in 2001. He's also a co-anchor of Squawk Box, a business news program on CNBC. Sorkin is the go-to authority on all things Wall Street, and it's been that way for a long time. In 2009, he authored Too Big to Fail, the definitive account of the 2008 financial crisis. Today, Sorkin joins me to discuss the psychology of Wall Street titans, the relationship between the stock market and the economy, and what it was like to interview Bernie Madoff. That's coming up. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey folks, exciting news. Stay Tuned with Preet has been nominated for a People's Voice Webby Award for Best Episode of a News and Politics Podcast. The episode features my conversation with Dan Goldman last year, who offered us his first interview after serving as lead House Majority Counsel during the first impeachment of President Trump. Head to webbyawards.com to vote. You can also find a direct voting link in the show notes of this episode. Thanks, as always, for your support. Before I get to your questions, I want to mention that you should stick around to the end of the show. I have a special surprise, a one-on-one with my brother, Vinny Bharara. So I'm recording this on the morning of Wednesday, April 21st, and still processing and digesting the historic verdict in the case against Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. And I spoke about it yesterday on the Cafe Insider podcast. And also, we talked about the case together with Joyce Vance. And I've received some questions about it, so I'll answer those. And of course, there'll be a lot more to discuss in the coming days. The one thing I want to reiterate is just how important this verdict was, not just for the stakeholders in that particular case and the family of George Floyd, but for the country and the sense of relief that so many people have felt, which is natural. I've been in a lot of courtrooms and I've seen and taken a lot of verdicts, including in cases that I personally tried. And I think my heart was beating just as fast waiting for the verdict to come back in the Chauvin case as any other case that I had a personal involvement in. Because we had an hour's notice that the verdict was coming and my kids were all home, we all gathered in the family room, which is an unusual event in my house lately, together as a family, see what the verdict was. And I'll never forget that. So the case is not over. More things have to happen. We've gotten questions about the sentencing. As you may know, on the three counts on which Derek Chauvin was convicted, he faces statutory maximums of 40 years, 25 years, and 10 years, respectively. Probably won't get that, but those are the statutory maximums. Sentencing will be in about 8 weeks. But between now and then, the judge has to take many things into consideration. And here's a question about that in an email from listener Kyle. Hi, Preet. After Chauvin's guilty verdict was read, the judge mentioned something called Blakely factors. Can you explain what that means and how it affects this case? Thanks, Kyle. So the Blakely factors, as they're called, come from a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2004 called Blakely v. Washington. And it's one of a number of cases that basically held that in connection with sentencing, any fact that increases what the proper sentencing should be for a defendant needs to be found beyond a reasonable doubt by the jury. The judge ultimately renders the sentence, imposes the sentence, but if there's some fact, like drug weight or something else, that affects the range of sentencing, a defendant has a right for that to be determined by the jury. And in Blakely, the Supreme Court held that the presumptive sentence was whatever the sentence would be under the guidelines, federal, state, or otherwise. And here, the prosecution has indicated that it seeks an upward departure from whatever the guidelines would ordinarily suggest, based on a couple of factors, including that the killing of Mr. Floyd happened in the presence of children, that Mr. Floyd was treated with particular cruelty, and that he abused his position of authority as a police officer. Now, although it's the case under Blakely that Chauvin had the right for the jury to decide those things, he waived that right and allowed it to be determined by the court. So the court, when it considers these aggravating factors like particular cruelty and abusive position of authority, will get briefing from the parties. There'll be a hearing, an argument about it, and then the judge will decide. Here's a question in a tweet from Brandon at BJM11, who asks, when Chauvin appeals, one, is the court required to give him another hearing or can that be declined? And two, would a subsequent trial start on a fresh slate or does the prior guilty verdict have any impact? So first, let me say as an initial matter, Chauvin has a right of appeal no matter what. And in most jurisdictions, there is an oral argument. So it wouldn't be a hearing, but there would be an argument in which Chauvin and the prosecutors will argue about whether or not there was some error that the trial court engaged in that should undo the trial verdict. I think by and large, the Judge Cahill did a pretty good job, but the defense lawyer made a record and every single time he objected to something and his objection was overruled can form an arguable basis for appeal. The defense lawyer, for example, complained about how the prosecution in its rebuttal summation and otherwise belittled the defense. There was an objection to proceeding with trial on the timetable that it did and in the venue where it did, because of potential prejudice that came from the $27 million settlement on the eve of the trial commencing. There were issues about jurors. There's an issue about Representative Maxine Waters having said something about not accepting an acquittal in the case. All of those points were made by defense counsel. They could form the basis for an appeal. My judgment is very, very unlikely for any of those points to be successful. But in case it were, going to your second question, and the verdict were overturned and there was a new trial scheduled, the prior guilty verdict per se has no effect. You begin with a clean slate, with the presumption of innocence, with the overwhelming burden of proof resting on the prosecutor's shoulders to have to prove once again to a unanimous jury. There's some complications that could potentially arise depending on how the second trial would unfold, which I don't think will take place, but to honor the hypothetical, I'll mention a couple of them. One is jury selection will be a little bit more difficult. It was already difficult given how sensational the case was and how much information and public information there was about the case to find people who knew some of the facts of the case. Could they be fair or not? It's going to be hard to find people who were not aware of the fact of the prior guilty verdicts. You know, naturally that might affect some people's abilities to be fair if there were a second trial. So jury selection will be a challenge. And then second, to the extent some of the witnesses in a potential second trial testify in a way that's at variance with how they testified in the first trial, you can imagine the judge allowing cross-examination of those witnesses based on the different testimony. They would have to be careful not to indicate that there was a prior trial of Derek Chauvin and that there was a guilty verdict. There are ways to get around that. But anytime people testify twice, it can create complications for those witnesses and the side that calls that witness. And as I mentioned, jury selection might be a little bit trickier. But as I said, I don't expect there to be a successful appeal here.
It's time for a short break. Stay tuned.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from Atlassian.
One of our customers who produces pizza at a very large scale all across the world. Believe it or not, they use AI to review the quality of the pizzas that are created. That goes through a workflow that scans the images of the pizzas and makes sure they visually look like what they should. So it's pretty cool.
That's Sharif Mansour, Atlassian's head of AI. Sharif thinks there's a lot for companies to be excited about on the AI-generated horizon, spanning everything from making pizza to producing podcasts like the one you're listening to now.
There'll be far more jobs created on the other side of this revolution.
Instead of a world of less, Sharif envisions an AI-powered world of more.
In everyone's day job, they're moving from doing the thing to often being an architect of the thing. It unleashes the potential of every human. And I think we can go from a world where few people have access to a high level of intelligence to a lot more people having access to this information. AI is really giving everyone on the planet more resources to do great things. And I'm very optimistic about that opportunity that lies ahead.
Transform teamwork with the power of AI-human collaboration. Start using Atlassian Intelligence for your Atlassian products like Jira and Confluence now. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com.
My guest today is Andrew Ross Sorkin. He's a financial columnist for the New York Times and a co-anchor of Squawk Box on CNBC. Sorkin is perhaps the most well-sourced journalist on Wall Street. Every morning, he publishes Deal Book, a business newsletter that is essential reading for CEOs and policymakers alike. Today, Sorkin joins me to discuss CEO pay, how money changes people, and whether we should be worried about some of the recent trends on Wall Street.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Long overdue. I don't know what's taken us so long.
I'm a big fan and a longtime listener, so it's a privilege to be here with you.
And first-time caller.
Yes, very much so.
You know, before we start, I just want to say one thing off the top. We were scheduled to record this interview on Tuesday of this week, April 20th, and the time set, you know, for some days, and you're a super busy person, the time set was 4:30, and we got on the Zoom, as we do now in the pandemic, and the whole world was waiting for the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case, and you very gallantly suggested, you know, let's put this off so you and us and everyone else can see what happens with the verdict. It's a big, important date, and so I appreciate that. And we rescheduled for this morning because you were a gentleman. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you. And I also knew that we were, you know, this was a big moment in our country. And also given what you do and the important commentary work you do and everything else, that this was something that you needed to be focused on. So I thought interviewing me was not going to work.
Well, this is very important, but I think it'll be a less distracted and more focused interview. And as far as I'm concerned, it was the right result yesterday, and we'll see what more good comes of that. Here's a thing that happened recently, and it made me think of a conversation that you and I had some years ago, and that is the passing of Bernie Madoff, the most epic Ponzi schemer in history,
yep,
who was prosecuted by my office, the Southern District of New York. And you had occasion to spend a lot of time with him, I think 5 years ago, 2016?
Yep.
What did you feel when he passed away? And tell folks what it was like to spend hours with him in his prison.
Oh, goodness. You know, what I felt more than anything as a journalist was actually a regret because I, even to this day, don't believe that the public got to see him truly face, not justice, because obviously he was in prison, but face real questions about his conduct and his behavior. And as you know, what I was trying to do and the reason I was going down and visited with him in prison twice was effectively to persuade him and ultimately the prison to allow us to bring cameras inside for the first time because he's done some interviews, but all, you know, written either in books or magazines or whatnot. But to me, for the public to see what deception looks like, and to viscerally be able to sort of see that, I always thought would be very worthy, in part because as a culture, I don't think oftentimes, and I don't mean to say this cynically, but that we as a culture are not skeptical enough, especially when it comes to our own personal finances and really trying to understand what's going on with these things. And I think it would have served an important public service for people to see it.
Like a warning, like a cautionary tale?
I believe it, not because it would have been revelatory insofar as that his answers would have shocked you, but because it at least for me, it was just such a profound demonstration of deception. And in fact, even for me, when I remember visiting with him, there were times he would tell these, you know, enthralling stories that all sounded true and you'd sort of believe it. And then I remember leaving the prison once, standing in the parking lot, and it was like you couldn't tell what was fact or fiction, you know?
And Did you find him to be contrite at all?
The first time I went down there, he was not contrite at all. Not contrite at all. I mean, it was like the opposite of contrite, which I also think would have been fascinating for the public to see. The second time I went down, I think he cried for like 2 hours. It was fascinating, which also, of course, raises so many questions about what I saw the first time. And maybe this goes back to the idea of, you know, the way a sociopath acts. But
what did you ask him that got him to cry for 2 hours?
It's funny. I'm not sure what inspired the crying. I do remember talking about his son who had committed suicide, but I just think he was so sad about his condition. And so the question was he contrite or was he just depressed about his own situation?
When you talked to him, did you think to yourself, I can see how this guy fooled and ripped off so many people, many of whom were sophisticated, not all, but many. Or did you find yourself thinking, how the hell did this guy swindle people out of, you know, literally billions of dollars?
Oh, no, I could see it. I could see it. In fact, it was so clear to me because he was a remarkable storyteller. I mean, look, here I was. I know his background. I know the story. I know he swindled billions of dollars out of people. And then I'm believing certain stories he's telling me in the moment. In fact, then as I said to you, I almost had to double back in my head to realize, okay, even that I'm not sure was true. So, yeah, no, there was something he had a talent, maybe is overstating the case, but he had a talent to be convincing, no question.
In your travels talking to people, you know, I just use the term sophisticated person, who we think of as somebody who, you know, sort of inured to lies and, you know, being cheated, and time after time, and I write about some of these examples in my book, you know, people who we think of as, you know, polished and sophisticated and smart get duped. Do we make too much of a distinction in the financial world between sophisticated and unsophisticated people?
Yes and no. I think that there is a level of sophisticated person who clearly understands the markets and finance and economics at a level, frankly, that puts them at a remarkable advantage. I mean, I would argue to you that the markets unto themselves have never been a true level playing field, in part because of that and because of a sort of financial literacy that exists. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of folks, even at that level, that are willing to sort of either close their eyes or believe in all sorts of things. I think we're in a bit of a, you know, whatever you think this Dogecoin, Bitcoin, whatever, there's a bubble going on of some sort with lots of arguably very sophisticated people who believe. They're believers. And even the most sophisticated, I think, can get sucked into certain things.
You mentioned financial literacy, and I've asked this question of a number of people. What do you think is the rate or level of financial literacy in America?
Abysmally low. I think most people have no idea.
Is that because people don't watch CNBC every day?
No. It's because some of this stuff is hard, but more importantly, it's really not taught in most places especially at young ages. So the idea of credit, is credit a good thing? Is credit a bad thing? How does credit really work? That's a fundamental part of our economy. And I can tell you that credit can be a great thing and credit can be a terrible thing, but you have to understand it to some degree before you can even begin to even think about it or opine on it. So I'm just not sure that people appreciate a lot of these issues. I think it has a huge implication for public policy, how we think about tax policy in America, how we think about R&D, how we think about incentives. I mean, all of these things, you know, have such a huge impact on society. And yet I think if you really talk to people around the country, there's just a very, and I hate to say it because you're effectively, people think that you're effectively saying they're ignorant. And that's not what I'm trying to say, but I think there's not necessarily a particularly acute sophistication about understanding a lot of these issues.
And separate from the policy issue, it has an impact and effect on people's own personal finances, right? And then on the one hand, you say, well, if you're not sophisticated or very sort of immersed in these issues, how to manage your money, you're supposed to rely on a financial planner or some other person, a stockbroker, if you have enough money to invest in stocks. And then you have people like Bernie Madoff who take advantage. And it's hard to know who to trust and who not to trust. And I guess one question I have is, I was only half kidding about CNBC. If you're a thoughtful person who's listening to this program and you want to become more educated on issues of finance and the stock market and everything else, what's your advice to them? Should they watch you every day? Are there books that they can read? Should they pick up the Wall Street Journal? Is there something more obvious than that or less obvious?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. But I think the most important thing is to actually do research. I think there's some great instructional stuff online that's really helpful. I think you need to be reading the newspaper every day, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, hopefully Deal Book.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mention the Wall Street Journal, Mr. New York Times guy.
No. But I forgot
who I was talking to.
No, but you should absolutely. I mean, I think everybody should be.
You read all the papers, right?
Oh, I for me personally, I read all this, everything. But I think all of that is helpful in terms of trying to get your head around what all of this means, and whether it's your personal finances that you're trying to figure out, or whether it's some of these larger, as I said, policy issues and where you stand politically on them, I think it's important to try to get educated on what all of the different component parts are. And by the way, also to listen to both sides, especially when it comes to the policy stuff, because, you know, these things are on the surface, oftentimes sound very political, but if you actually dig in and you can look at the numbers and once you understand it, you can make your own decisions about it.
So maybe you can help educate me on something, on a couple of things with respect to the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
So the stock market, politicians say with great emphasis, the stock market is not the economy. It does not reflect the economy. Is that a slogan or is that correct?
It's right and wrong. And the stock market reflects what we'll call the investor class. And some of the investor class, of course, are retail investors, which means, you know, people on the street who have views, and more, you know, people on the street, if you will, are, and I'm not talking about Wall Street, are investing. So there is a sort of, I don't know if you call it wisdom of crowds issue going on, but it's what the market is projecting out, what people think the economy is going to look like 12 months, 18 months, 24 months out from now. So, you know, during the pandemic, one of the things that I think blew everybody's mind, by the way, including my own all the time, was, you know, we'd hear these terrible things going on in terms of unemployment rate, the economy falling, it just terrible, everything tragic. And yet you'd see the stock market go up and you'd be like, what is going on here? This is crazy town, right? This makes no sense. And the truth is what was happening where investors were saying, okay, we're not looking at what happened today or even in the rearview mirror of what happened yesterday. We're effectively making a bet that in 12 months from now, in 18 months from now, you know, the vaccine will be out. People will go back to work. And what's that world going to look like? So I guess the answer to your question is while the stock market doesn't necessarily reflect the economy per se, especially right now, and by the way, people can be wrong because they're guessing, right? This is all a bit speculative. The speculation, if you will, is that the economy will be better. And so there is a bit of a correlation, but not in the here and now.
Should everyone who has some savings be in the stock market?
Oh goodness, I hate to.
Do we need to have some kind of caveat here and say, Mr. Andrew Ross Sorkin is not providing financial advice, and you invest at your own risk.
Thank you, counselor. Thank you, counselor. Okay. Yes, because I actually I don't like to offer true stock advice. Look, my sense is that if you have some savings over time, it is better to be in the stock market than not on a long-term basis, as long as you're a long-term investor. You know, if you're buying into a stock index and you plan to be there for 10, 20, 30 years, yes, absolutely. If you're telling me that you need this money in 6 months from now, no, it's a very bad idea to put that money in the stock market.
Because anything can happen. You can enter a pandemic.
Anything can happen. A pandemic can happen. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow?
But do you think, I guess you sort of answered this, is there any real rationality to the market? And you've been covering it and writing about it and thinking about it for years and years. So your pronouncement matters to me.
I do think it's reflective of where the economy is going. I think that's true. I mean, I think you saw where we were.
Where people think it's going.
Where people think it's going. Yes. I think
people are often wrong, just like they are about politics and about Donald Trump and everything else.
People are often wrong, but I think it is as a signal indicator, if you will, of where people think things are going. Absolutely. And by the way, you know, there are companies and that make money, and you can see their balance sheet, and you can see if they're making more money this quarter or less money this quarter, and if they're employing more people or less people. And there's no question. You look at a company like Amazon, now its stock has gone through the roof. It's actually come back a little bit, but that company has been a great success story and became an even greater success story during the pandemic. And the stock market reflected that.
Well, now its earnings are huge. I remember when Amazon began and had its rise, and I would hear people say about Amazon what a lot of people say about some other companies, and maybe there are distinctions to be made. But in the late 90s, I might have this off by a few years, but in the late 90s and the early 2000s, Amazon kept growing and growing and growing, and there was no profitability in sight.
Right. I remember the same thing. People used to call it, I remember there was a cover story that said, maybe it was Fortune or Forbes, said Amazon.com.
Right. And how did Amazon do during the pandemic?
Fabulously. I mean, unbelievably.
And profitability?
Huge.
Gigantic.
But that required a remarkable level of patience among the investor class. And there was a belief that Jeff Bezos was going to get there. He was sort of given dispensation in a way, frankly, that most companies don't have to make these kind of long-term investments, to lose money for as long as he did. And along the way, it's worth noting that while you and I and most people think of Amazon as a Prime membership or something that brings you packages to your home, a huge part of the business developed in the middle of it called AWS, which is effectively a cloud service, which is actually the most profitable part of that business. And it helped to some degree subsidize the rest of everything else and allow that to then build and grow.
But do some people, I guess this is true, as I say it, I realize it must be true of some folks. They look at the Amazon story and they think back, well, you know, I thought that lots of people thought of Amazon.com as Amazon.com, as you mentioned. And now when I have an investment opportunity with respect to something that's new and different, as Amazon was at the time, and it's not profitable, and there's no near-term expectation of profitability, I think to myself, well, this could be the next Amazon, and I could be on Easy Street and early retirement if I put all my money in this. How often does that happen?
I mean, that's what you're speaking to.
The American dream.
Is the American dream. But in many ways, Amazon was the shoot the moon American dream, and it succeeded. And the truth is that so many of the other companies that also had no earnings or revenue back then disappeared and went bankrupt. And so it is very hard to really be able to choose and be able to identify a company at that early stage as a winner. You know, the venture capital model is that, you know, effectively most of the investments are going to fail. And you're effectively trying to, you're hoping a couple of your investments, you know, are grand slam home runs, because the rest of them, you're not even going to get to first base. And so it really depends on how you think about how you invest and do you have a portfolio? You know, if you're investing in 30 different companies and you're sort of just praying and hoping against hope that one works, that might actually not be a bad way to do it. If you're putting your chip down on one of these companies and that's it, that's a riskier play.
So we've talked a little bit about sophisticated people, sophisticated investors, whatever that means. But there is a definition that is applicable in connection with putting money into a hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
And you spend a lot of time thinking about hedge funds. I have, from a prosecutorial standpoint, and we've prosecuted people who are hedge fund managers, prosecuted firms that are, in fact, hedge funds themselves. And this was not a concern of mine when I was in office. My concern was about insider trading and criminality and misconduct and ripping people off and that sort of thing. As a practical matter, do you know what percentage of hedge funds over time beat the S&P 500?
Oh, for the most part, they don't.
They don't. So explain this to me. Any idiot like myself, and I don't mean to call other people idiots, I'm calling myself an idiot. If you do what they say and you dollar cost average, meaning every period, if you're lucky enough to have excess, you know, savings, and I am, and you put a certain amount of money in the S&P 500, it's kind of idiot proof to use that term again. And over time, you have a certain gain on your investment and there's very low cost. I don't have to prove myself to have, you know, certain metrics to qualify as a sophisticated investor. And then there are other people who have millions of dollars and they put them into these fancy hedge funds and I do better. How do hedge funds thrive if that's the case? I don't get it.
Okay, so...
I mean, maybe it's a dumb question, but no. For the life of me, I don't get it.
So first of all, you're right, and you are right there with Warren Buffett, who...
That's good company. Is that good company?
It's a very good company. And he has advised everybody. He writes it in his own annual letters. He says, look, if I was telling my family what to do, I would tell them to buy a stock index. I would not tell them to buy into a hedge fund or put my money elsewhere. In fact, he's had a running bet against hedge funds with certain hedge funds about whether they're going to beat the index. And invariably, he's been right. So—
It's some really small, I wish I had the figure in front of me, but it's not the case. It's like, well, you know, 65% beat the index and 35% don't. It's some very small number over time. And, you know, and I have friends who work at hedge funds and I like them and they're very smart and they're upstanding people. But if we're talking about an area that is susceptible to analysis and, you know, mathematical analysis, and rationality, I'm going to repeat my question because I like asking it. What the hell are people doing putting billions of their dollars into a thing that over time, by almost every measure, at least in the last 20 years, maybe it was not true before that, by every measure cannot outperform the S&P 500?
Two things. You're talking about the American dream. People dream. They believe that they can outperform the market. And because some of these hedge funds do for a short period of time, they want to play in that arena. That's the look.
They're looking for the lottery ticket.
This is a lottery ticket game. Think about Bill Ackman. So Bill Ackman's a famed hedge fund manager who has been remarkably successful in certain years. I mean, literally this last year, he's up some 70% during the pandemic. He called it 100% right. And kudos to him. But there have been years where he has lost a small fortune making terrible bets.
Small fortune to him. Small fortune. To allow to be able to big fortune.
Small fortune to him, exactly. But the point is that I think, unfortunately, what happens is people say to themselves, I want that lottery ticket. That's why people go to the bodega to buy the lottery ticket. And this is to some degree, this is the equivalent of that, just with a lot more money.
I hear you. Mm-hmm. But by definition, the people who are permitted to invest in hedge funds by a lot of people's metrics have already won the lottery. By and large, they are millionaires already. And so you're saying the millionaires want a lottery ticket too?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it does.
That will come as a surprise. Like that analogy, I mean, you know, you and I are talking about this sort of, I don't mean to say it's blasé,
right.
but- That's a little bit of a shocking thing to the ears of the average American, that people who have millions of dollars, the kind of money that most Americans will never see in their lifetime, that those people are prepared to invest in ways that they feel are lottery tickets for them to go from millionaire to billionaire, I suppose, and end up not doing as well as somebody who has the patience of Warren Buffett or someone else.
But isn't that one of the great lessons about money? You know, I think money does change people, and I don't want to suggest it doesn't at all in any way. But I do think that one of the truths that I've discovered after covering this world for the last 20 years is that whether you have a fancy, you know, title on your business card, or you have $1 million in the bank or $1 billion in the bank, the human instinct, I don't think, is actually that different.
People want more.
People want more. You know, there's a great line in Wall Street, not the original Wall Street, which of course has the great greed is good line, but in the in Wall Street 2, which was not as good a movie.
It was not as good.
But there was a question that I think either Michael Douglas or somebody asked, and they said,
"See, I find that everybody has a number, and it's usually an exact number. So what is yours?"
More.
Look, you covered these cases. You know, there was, you know, these insider trading cases we brought when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, one against a man by the name of Rajaratnam, who was a billionaire.
Yep.
Another against a man by the name of Rajat Gupta, who was estimated to be worth about $100 million. $100 million, pretty good. And, you know, when you bring a prosecution, you're not overly concerned about the psychology of why someone does it. But the sense I got in my armchair psychologist role is that he wanted more. And he looked at a guy like, you know, Rajaratnam, and this is speculation on my part and what I know of human nature. And he said, "I can't believe that guy has $1 billion and I only have $100 million. And so he entered into a conspiracy with him and gave him inside information and lost his reputation in the process, convicted at trial, and went to prison. And he already had $100 million because more.
Because more. And I would also just add to that by saying, what you see over and over again, especially among those who have a lot to begin with, is in certain cases, it's actually not even about the money per se in terms of what that money can buy. It becomes at some level, at those levels, a scorecard for power and for pride and for
status.
I mean, I think that's what happens. You know, it's so interesting because I think there are people at the, you know, who don't have money who are robbing stores or you know, doing other things because they want to pay the mortgage or they want to pay for rent. That's different. That's a sort of a very different motivation.
When we were talking about insider trading, when we were doing those cases, you know, there was sort of a revelation, at least that I had, because the defense always is, I mean, the inverse of all of this is when someone gets caught who's already rich, they say, well, why would I do that? Why would my client do that? He's already rich, right?
Right.
Playing on the question that I just asked you. And of course, it's much more complicated to explain the more philosophy, you know, to put it tersely. And then you realize that in many contexts, it's the people who are already successful and already have a lot of money who are built a certain way that they cheat. So for example, the analogy I used was people who doped up. And you know, it wasn't the crappy player, you know, who was the backup quarterback or, you know, the benched baseball player. It was people like Lance Armstrong, who did work hard, who did have probably more talent than anyone else in the world, but he wanted more and he wanted to always win. And that's not something that people are necessarily, you know, built to understand. And you look at people who are successful like that and you say, well, why would you, you're already the best in the world. Why would you cheat? And even for Lance Armstrong, right? Because more,
but also, and I've spent time with him as well.
You like to hang out, you know, you should hang out with me.
I love fascinating stories and fascinating characters and fascinating people and invariably—
Crooks, you like
well,
crooks.
But the truth is that there's a great drama to crooks and to people who have had these ups and downs. And I'm somebody who believes— ultimately, that underneath it all, if you can actually get there to them, and sometimes you can't, that there's a way to understand it. Not necessarily a way to accept what they've done, but I'm always fascinated to try to understand why they think what they think and why they thought in the moment that they, you know, conducted the crime or whatever it was, you know, how they thought they were going to get away with it. But so much of these examples that you're talking about are some of the most competitive people in the world, whether in sport or on Wall Street. It's a battle of wits, right? People are trying to outsmart each other. That's part of the, you know, on Wall Street, by the way, that's part of the business. It's how do you outsmart the other person? And sometimes I
don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you.
But sometimes outsmarting the other person, unfortunately, they're a little too smart for their own good, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You've interviewed a lot of people who have a lot of money. And I'm going to ask you to play armchair psychologist for a second. Do you find that by and large, they are more happy, less happy, or no different from people of ordinary means?
Oh, goodness. Mostly no different. I don't know if they're materially less happy per se, but I think sometimes money obviously can create great unhappiness because people are fighting over money and changes relationships and dynamics and all sorts of things. Happiness, maybe some of them get to go on a better vacation. I do think, what money does do, and people have said this to me many times before, is it while it can create lots of issues for certain people, depends on how much money we're talking about, it can take sort of one issue off the table. As something that
paying the bills
that you're not thinking that those people are not thinking about that in the same way that most Americans are. Most Americans, I think, are spending, a decent part of their life thinking about paying the bill. Am I going to have enough money? Am I going to have my kids? Are my kids going to be able to go to school? Am I going to pay? Or am I going to pay a loan?
There's insecurity.
Yep.
If you lose your job, and look at the pandemic, and you know, people who have a lot of money, you know, had a better time of it.
Totally.
During the pandemic because they had a cushion.
Exactly. In many ways, by the way, money also allows people to take risks that they might not otherwise take as well because of the cushion that you just talked about.
Well, it's, you know, this is the mathematics of compounding interest or whatever other analogy you want to use. It's a lot easier to get to $2 billion from $1 billion than to get from zero to $1 billion. And from $1 million to $2 million than from zero to $1 million, right?
100%. But, you know, I always think about Dick Fold. Richard Fold was the CEO of Lehman Brothers, you know, before the financial crisis and into the financial crisis. And he's somebody who had over $1 billion of stock in his company. And he rode the stock all the way down to $56,000. And people said there was a guy who was a true believer. But if you turn the story around, he's somebody who also had made and had in the bank several $100 million already. And so he was able in many ways to take a remarkable risk. And while it may have looked like he had $1 billion of stock in his company, you know, all the skin in the game that we always say people talk about wanting in terms of trying to incentivize people, in many ways it was just the cherry on top. And maybe he could afford to lose that cherry.
Yeah. Although some people, you know, in his position still would not have done that. Can I ask you something else that angers folks and angers me too?
Okay.
Since we didn't really resolve the hedge fund issue.
Yep.
And that's CEO compensation.
Uh-huh.
And I know that over time, there's been, you know, a more dramatic gap between either the lowest paid person at a company or the average paid person at the company and the CEO, and most people in America are not CEOs. But there is a question about what value they bring and whether their interests are aligned with the companies. And this was an extraordinary report that came out not that long ago. And it sets forth that CEO pay generally surged during the pandemic. Median pay for the chief executives of more than 300 of the biggest U.S. public companies went from $12.8 million to $13.7 million. And then most dramatically, and people love to hate on this kind of thing, myself included, the CEO of Norwegian Cruise Line.
Yep. Unbelievable.
Which recorded a $4 billion loss last year. Because I don't, did you take a cruise last year, Andrew?
I'm not sure.
I didn't.
I don't think I've ever taken a cruise, to be honest with you.
I don't think I ever will. I did take a cruise once with my family. That CEO of Norwegian Cruise Line, his pay doubled to $36.4 million. Mm-hmm. Not that you're, you know, his keeper, but what the hell is going on there?
Well, I don't know if I can speak to the Norwegian Cruise issue, but I can definitely speak to the larger issue of CEO pay, which is literally makes no sense at all. And the reason is, it really is, I mean, I don't know if you could bring a RICO case against companies. And
well, not now.
Maybe not now, but—
Podcasters don't have RICO capabilities.
But, you know, what's so strange about CEO pay is it's set by a board, oftentimes with consultants. The consultants, of course, are paid by the board to keep effectively ratcheting up these numbers. But it's not about, there's nothing about competitive pricing. So, you know, if you, Preet, or I were to hire somebody today, I think you would probably say to yourself, I want to try to hire somebody for whatever that job is at a fair market rate. You probably don't want to pay too much more than that. And hopefully you don't want to pay too much less than that, because arguably you would like to make this a sustainable job. But that's not the conversation that happens in the boardroom. Nobody says, is this, you know, if the CEO left tomorrow and had to go get a job somewhere else, you know, what would they get paid? You know, how are they really also going to get paid $50 million a year? Is there another place that is going to do that? And I've always been sort of struck by the fact that there is no genuine market in that way. Now, yes, there are certain executives that probably could get some of that kind of pay, but I think most of them probably couldn't. But one other thing I'd say is, you know, we look at public company CEOs because we see these numbers and they're public and you get to see it. But the thing that's extraordinary that often is not covered enough is the numbers of private companies. And, you know, you talked about hedge funds and the like. There are people, forget about CEOs making $40 million a year. There are people making $800 million a year. I mean, literally $800 million. And I'm not just talking about people who have stock in their company because the stock went up. They're literally, you know, you look at Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone. He's made an enormous amount of money. I mean, just literally off of the fees of the company in a given year. Some of these other hedge fund managers have done remarkably. And so—
Well, but it's one thing, and those are extraordinary figures, and I don't know how those places do overall. But it's one thing to make a lot of money if the company is making a lot of money and you're taking some share of that. But the logic of making an enormous amount of money and having an increase in your salary when other people are being laid off seems just not just nonsensical, but downright corrupt to people. Are they right to feel that way?
I think they are in many ways, especially when a company is failing or a company is not doing well. It seems crazy that you would be compensating the CEO for more. Look, this is the complicated part to me about capitalism and how we think about employees in America. All too often, I would argue over the last, say, 30, 40 years, employees are thought of in the same way that simply thought of as costs. Maybe just think about it as costs. You know, you could spend money on technology, you could spend money on people, you could spend money on marketing, you could spend money on this, you could spend money on that. And so when a company takes out cost, whether they are people or whether they are light bulbs, the investor class treats them the same. And that's the problem, that we've sort of lost a sense of humanity in all of this. And I think it's coming back a little bit in terms of the conversation that the business community is now having about the role that they play in society. But I think it still has a long way to go.
I'm going to move on to something else that makes people angry. And I think this makes you angry too. And we've talked about this. You know, we mentioned insider trading before. So you're a journalist. You've done very well. And you talk about companies and you talk to a lot of people who are at companies. Are you allowed under the rules of your journalistic employers, the New York Times or CNBC, either or both, are you allowed to invest and trade in individual stocks?
Not at all.
Why is that?
One is I'm often privy to effectively inside information. I you know, my job is to ferret out information before it reaches the public. And secondly, I would never want, and neither would the news organizations that I work for, ever want there to be even a scintilla of a question about my motivations or incentives to write or report or talk about a particular issue or a particular news item. I mean, to me, that's sacrosanct, right? I mean, and so
yes, absolutely. So and no, not to downplay your importance and influence, because you are influential. but let me ask the follow-up question. Are you now or have you ever been a member of the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate?
I have not. I'm not now, nor have I ever been, nor do I imagine I ever will.
And if elected, I shall not serve. And would you agree with me that those people, senators and representatives, have real power and authority as lawmakers? Correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm doing it this way.
No, you're doing it like a prosecutor should. I'm with you.
Every once in a while, I feel like doing a direct examination.
No, and this is the right way to do it because it's ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
And members of Congress mm-hmm. can invest and trade in individual stocks, even though on a regular basis, they serve on committees and they vote on legislation, even if it's not something that they're the chair of the committee for, but vote all the time on things that they presumably have either inside information about or some conflict of interest, or the same two things that you talked about. And we put up with that. I mean, I was a staffer. We talked about this before you wrote your column a couple of months ago that was excellent. I was just a staffer. And I found it, you know, crazy to trade in individual stocks because all day long I had meetings with people and there were folks who had interests in the telecommunications industry, various technology fields, et cetera. And this is why you get these questions about members of the Senate in the last year, and no cases were brought, but there was a case brought against a particular congressman, was pardoned by the president, engaged in communications of insider trading while on the White House lawn. But what the hell is going on with that? Why doesn't Congress police itself better and say, you know what? If Andrew Ross Sorkin, who again, not to downplay it, is a mere journalist, ethics requires that he not trade in individual stocks, how about our elected representatives in Congress?
Look, and seen. I don't understand it. I can't get my head around it. Congress has been unwilling to police itself. The regulatory agencies have been unwilling to make it a priority to try to police them. You know, I wrote this column effectively suggesting that the SEC stand up and say we're gonna start policing Congress ourselves. Of course, the conundrum if you're Gary Gensler running the SEC is. You know, your budget is set by these same people. And so I think over the years, no regulator appointed or otherwise has really wanted to, you know, bite the hand that feeds it. And that is the problem. And asking people to police themselves has never been a particularly successful strategy. And so here we are. And I think it's going to take some real leadership from somebody. I'm not sure who's going to be the one to stand up to say enough is enough, because why should the American public has so much skepticism and cynicism already about politics and about policy and how it's made. Why not just take this piece off the table? I mean, it's so crazy that this is even allowed to happen when, as you've said, you know, I'm not allowed to own stocks. There's a lot of businesses that don't allow their employees to own stocks, or they have to go through, you know, remarkable vetting programs and things like that.
If you're at a law firm, generally you have to do that. Mm-hmm. If you're a staff member at the SEC, I think you have to do that. But Congress doesn't have to do anything. Anyway, put that on the list of things in your platform for when you run.
And by the way, full disclosure, I should say that I am allowed and do own shares of my two employers. So I do own shares of the New York Times Company and Comcast, but I am a long-term holder, as they say.
Got it. That makes sense. Here's a thing that you need to help me understand and other people understand. So everyone, I think, over time has come to understand the idea of an initial public offering and going public, and people have a general sense of what that means. Now there's a new thing called a SPAC. What on God's earth is a SPAC, and should we be concerned about that thing?
We should be so concerned about it. Here's what's happening. People are trying to call it what they call an IPO 2.0. This is the new version of going public.
It's 2.0, because more.
And what it is, effectively, is there are effectively investors who are starting what's called a blank check company. They go out and they actually do have a real IPO, and they raise money, let's say a couple $100 million, $1 billion. And it's called a blank check company because literally the company does nothing except take that money and go find an acquisition target, usually a private company that effectively is then going to be brought public, if you will, sort of through the back door, if you think about it like this, into the public markets through this publicly traded company. So
you avoid a lot of scrutiny, you avoid a lot of disclosures you have to make.
All of the rules that are applied to an IPO, which effectively means, you know, if you're a company going public for the first time, you typically can't make, you know, crazy future projections about what's going to happen 3, 4, 5 years from now. The SEC's looked, you know, down upon that. There's a lot, you know, you go through a whole process, a roadshow. Investors have to look through your books. It's a very difficult and often arduous process. This SPAC idea, in many ways, sort of short circuits that process. And most of the companies that are going public through this don't have revenue. This brings us back to, you know, the Amazon. So they don't have revenue. They don't have profits. And so they have to tell you what they're going to be doing 3, 4, 5 years from now. Of course, call me in 3, 4, 5 years from now. We'll see how accurate those projections are. But there's a lot of investors that have gotten a lot of excitement around these things, possibly too excited.
But so I understand how this works and people can follow. It can be anybody, you know, an individual who has some means.
We could do it together. We could go raise some money right now.
Okay, let's make it me.
Okay.
It's like I want to, or you, Andrew Ross Sorkin, you're going to create a SPAC.
Yep.
And you have a goal of raising, I don't know if you have to have a goal in advance, $500 million.
Yep.
And you call up your friends and you say, I'm starting a SPAC. It's a new hot thing. It's crazy. It's amazing. And you'll get rich with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask you the question, okay, Andrew, well, what kind of company do you intend to buy? Do you have to tell me? Do you even have to know?
I'm not supposed to know. I'm not supposed to know what company I'm trying to buy.
Or even the industry.
No, there are people who will say, yeah, with a specialty, they'll say, in my case, maybe they say I'd go buy a media company. So I'm going to look, I have an expertise, arguably, or maybe not, we'll see, in the media space. I'm going to go buy a media company. So people would say, okay, Sorkin, I'm going to give you the money. And you then have effectively 24 months. It's like a sprint. There's a deadline. Because if you don't spend the money in that 24-month period, you have to return it. In fact, you lose then.
But what requires the time limit?
It's just the way the instrument, if you will, is effectively set up. Arguably, I guess they could make it 3 years, 4 years, 5 years if they want. You effectively, though, provide interest on the investment they've given you if you can't find an investment. So it's actually for the people investing in these things initially, they're not really long-term investors. Most of these guys are just, it's a financial play for them.
The attractiveness of it is the wherewithal of the person starting the SPAC. And in your case, potentially, I'm knowledgeable about media. Someone else might be knowledgeable about tech, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a little bit, people are putting money in the SPAC on spec. Can I say that?
That's exactly what's happening. And then part of the reason why you're seeing so many celebrities, big names trying to do this, people in business, everyone, you know, Colin Kaepernick has a SPAC, A-Rod's got a SPAC, everybody's got a SPAC. In fact, it's a terrible, terrible line, but on Wall Street, there's a running line going that says, I know more people who have a SPAC than who have COVID, you know, ba-dum-bum, but not really. So anyway, but the reason they're doing this is because if they find an acquisition target, they get to keep 20% of the money that was put up initially. It's like the greatest deal around.
Well, so when you call me to set up your SPAC, do you have to put a dollar into it?
I do have to put a little bit of money into it, yes.
But not 20%?
But not, no. I put in a tiny, tiny, tiny amount just to show I have a little bit of skin in the game. But I don't really have any skin in the game, of course. No, this is a cash grab.
How ordinary people should be worried about this? How can this affect the economy?
Well,
a bubble situation.
Look, I think where the person on the street should be worried is you have a lot of companies going public that don't have real earnings, don't have real revenue, and you have a lot of these quote unquote sponsors, the people who are putting these SPACs together, who go out on TV, they put out press releases, they're on social media, trying to tell the public when they do buy some company how great it is. And I think people should just be wary because these quote unquote sponsors who are arguably saying, hey, I'm here, I vetted this thing, I'm buying in, I'm an investor in it, aren't really any of those things. They've gotten 20% of the company for free, effectively. And most of the time, they intend to sell their shares within 6 months to a year, far earlier than any of the projections that these companies are making about what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, and I would imagine, just thinking about this off the top of my head, when you have a two-year deadline and you get to month 20 and month 21, with the prospect of having to return all of your investors' money, that maybe you don't make the most intelligent and best decisions about your acquisition.
Exactly.
In the days leading up to the deadline.
And look,
right?
We have hundreds of billions of dollars chasing, you know, not enough companies effectively that are sustainable businesses that should be doing this. And I think one day, the next Preparara will be subpoenaing lots of emails that are going to show lots of misbehavior around what they know and what
because
they
there's an incentive to misrepresent when representations have to be made, even though fewer representations have to be made in this context. Because there's a lot of money to be made and there's a lot of loss to be avoided. And I guess it's great to be a fish in the sea who's being sought out by a SPAC because your valuations are going to go way up.
Well, and that's the thing. Your valuation will go way up. And a lot of venture capital-backed companies are using this moment effectively to try to get out as quickly as humanly possible. I mean, there's a rush to the – if you own a business, there's a rush to the exit. This is your shot. However, of course, you know – we're already starting to see a lot of the stocks of these companies are starting to fall. So we'll see. We'll see who ends up holding the bag.
Can you explain in 60 to 90 seconds this whole business of...
It takes me 60 to 90 seconds to clear my throat.
So this craziness with GameStop, which is a retail store chain store, which presumably would not have a brisk business during the pandemic... Lots of people, the hedge funds, we talked about hedge fund folks a few minutes ago, have been short on GameStop, meaning they're placing a bet that revenue and profitability will go down at that store chain. And then some other group of folks said, screw that, we're going to go long, and that's going to hurt the hedge fund folks. Some people say it was brilliant. Some people say it was rogue. Some people say it was reckless. Some people say it sends a message. What the hell is really going on? I feel like I've asked you this form of question three or four times. What the hell is going on?
So what's happening here is basically GameStop has long been assumed to be like the Blockbuster of our era, which is to say great at one time in a bricks and mortar world, but long term is going to struggle because people are going to download their games, not going to show up at a store. So the value of the company had gone down, but was still relatively high. And so there were a number of big hedge fund professional investors who said, this is nuts. And they started shorting the company, expecting the value to, over time, be much lower. At the same time, there was a group of investors online, might be described as a retail audience that's on Reddit and elsewhere, who say two things. One is that they actually believe in GameStop, and some of them genuinely believe that the business can be improved. But another very clever group said to themselves, you know what? There's so many shares that effectively are being held short. And we can talk about what it means to or how you short a company, but so many people betting against it that there's a way effectively to have what's called a short squeeze. That if enough people buy the stock and go long at the same time, you can actually create a almost self-fulfilling prophecy that will go even higher because those who have sold the company short effectively have to rebuy the shares. It's a little bit in the weeds, it's a little complicated, and therefore it will effectively press the price even higher. And we will stick it to the man. We will stick it to the suits by doing this. And we will demonstrate just how screwed up Wall Street really is. And so that's what happened. You had a group of people go to Reddit, get in the markets and start buying and buying and buying and buying to the point where a number of hedge funds lost billions of dollars on their short bets. Now, the stock is so high today. I mean, it's out to me, it defies logic and sense, but it sort of is representative of this moment that we're in the markets, and also the power of social media to sort of bring people together. It used to be, and look, you used to look at these things with hedge funds used to hang out, have dinners together, and they would get together and push the price of stocks. And these guys are saying, we can do that too.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, thanks for making the time and explaining so many things to me.
Oh, goodness. Thank you for having me and for explaining so many things back to me. Let's do it again.
My conversation with Andrew Ross Sorkin continues for members of the Cafe Insider community. To try out the membership free for 2 weeks, head to cafe.com/insider. Again, that's cafe.com/insider. So I want to end the show this week with a little bit of a follow-on to what I said at the end of the show last week, where I talked about the sale of the company to Vox Media, thanking folks, bidding farewell to Ann Milgram, and at the end, thanking my brother, who made all this possible. And I thought, what better way to follow up on that discussion than by asking my brother to be on Stay Tuned? And so he's my special guest at the end of the show. Vinny, are you here?
Hey, how are you?
How are you? Now, can I just at the outset ask you, do you prefer to be called kid brother or baby brother?
Boss brother.
So you're not my boss anymore.
True.
I think officially.
It's unfortunate.
Did it fulfill some childhood fantasy to be my boss?
Yeah, ever since I was five.
You said that a little bit too enthusiastic.
Yeah, ever since I was five.
When you were five, you used to say, I believe you would say things like, you're not the boss of me.
Exactly.
You're very specific.
No, because that was with the whole remote control. As you like to hold your audience last week, we used to fight about the remote control. You used to win more than I did. You were mom and dad's favorite.
I was not. You know,
so this is
your
my
mom
revenge.
And dad are going to listen to this. You can't say that.
They know. Everybody knows. So
no. That's
my
not,
revenge. No,
that's not true.
Okay.
How did you get me to do a podcast?
I don't know. Did I get you to do a pod? If you remember,
your voice got very high there. Why did
your
voice get so high?
It did. Because I'm just trying to remember back.
So remember, let me refresh your recollection. So I got fired.
Yeah.
You remember that, right? You're aware of that?
I do remember that.
I think you read it in the papers.
All day on CNN, that was breaking news.
Yeah. And then you and I had a conversation not long after that about what I might do next. And I'm trying to remember how the podcast, was it my idea or your idea?
You may not remember that prior to this discussion about you joining our media company.
Oh yeah, at some point in the future, we discussed one day I would have to leave, although I never really fully expected that I would ever leave, that this was an option. I remember that now.
Yeah, you convinced me when I was at Amazon trying to figure out what to do next. You were one of the folks that influenced me to go into media. I don't know if you remember. I was like, what should I do next? Yeah, you said media. Go to media. Media, so you can have an impact. You can influence.
Did you have podcasts already at the company?
No. My recollection was we chatted. We wanted to get you involved. I wanted to get you involved, certainly in some capacity. And we were trying to figure out, you know, how to do it.
Because I was your brother or because you thought I was a cash cow?
I thought you'd be good. I knew you'd be good. And you didn't want to have to wear any makeup. So we talked about the video. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, you really wanted me to do video?
Yeah, I wanted you to do video.
Yeah, this is before I decided to be a commentator on CNN.
Yeah, so this was like sort of, let's go slow. Let's try something that's a little easier. No makeup. On your own schedule. And that's what we did. That was my recollection of how we started.
And then did you expect it to do as well as it did?
I don't think I was stretching it to think that you'd be excellent for a bunch of different reasons. And I'm not just trying to, you know, brag about you here or make you feel good, but you're a missionary and as opposed to a mercenary. And what I find is that missionaries, when they're doing new products or any product at all, the best products come from them. And you care. You know, you care about your audience. You care about delivering a great product more than the financial part. And so I knew that the product would be excellent. I knew you'd be really good. What I didn't know, by the way, is this soothing voice you have. I didn't realize. afterwards,
it's the
like,
voice you hated. It's the voice
I didn't
you
know
hated.
This. If I had known that, yeah, Preet has a soothing voice. Now that was something I didn't know.
It's nice of you to say all that now, and I think you were optimistic, and you have faith in me, just like I have faith in you. I've invested in every single one of your companies, and always will, because I think you're the best business mind I know. But you know, it was still a leap of faith and a good bit of confidence you had in me. And you know, sometimes it's awkward for relatives to work together.
Yeah, but I don't know. You know, we've had a pretty,
I think we've
not
had
one fight,
not
right?
one fight or argument.
No.
People might not believe that, but it's
not one.
It's true, because I'm a very easygoing guy.
Exactly. No, I think
a very mellow
guy. I think we've been, it hasn't had any, to your point, no disagreements, no arguments, no fights, no awkward moments.
And yet, I mean, I don't know, just I'm paranoid a little bit. You know, was there something lurking beneath the surface that made you want to offload the company to Vox so you didn't have to be my boss anymore?
No.
Okay.
No. I
just wanted to get that on the record.
You told your audience why we did that.
I'm wondering if you maybe could give a minute of your own thoughts as to why this is a great thing and what the future holds for us with Vox Media.
Well, I got to know Jim Bankoff at Vox Media a couple of years ago, and we kept in touch. And we had a conversation in the beginning of this year about our respective companies and what they were doing. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for Jim. And when I've sold, you know, a few companies in the past, the biggest thing for me and that I've found is the culture fit. You know, when you're going into a new company or if you're going to sell your company to someone, it's a marriage. And you have to connect and click, and you have to have respect for the party that you're going to marry. And so that was a huge piece of this was Jim and Vox and those people over there are good people and they're similar. And we got along really well. So I thought that was, you know, the first piece. I think the second piece was just tactically now as a business, I thought that it was a great fit. You and your team produce super high quality journalistic content, and it fit, you know, really well with Vox's mission and what they do really well. And they have a lot of resources. It could get you a lot more audience. And I think you could go faster, a little bit faster with them than you could have been with us.
How hard is it to turn a startup into a successful company?
Hard, Preet. You know, now you were part of it, I think.
Yeah, but I'm lucky. So I did it one time and it worked out. In the industry, I mean, I'm not really a business person. In the industry, and you've been, you know, I don't know if people know, but, you know, you went to law school too. We both went to Columbia Law School, and then you stopped practicing law, although you're still an excellent lawyer. I can see your legal skills still at work from time to time. But having been out there and raised capital to start businesses, including diapers.com, which you sold to Amazon, maybe not everyone knows that story. What's the rate of success for the average startup?
Look, most startups fail. I think over 90% fail. And then I think a much smaller percentage, maybe 1 in 1,000 have the success that you had. Popular audience, millions of people listening or enjoying your product and then having a successful exit. So the odds are stacked against you. I think the hardest thing in doing these things is, and now again that you've been part of it, is that, you know, you're building something from scratch. You don't always know what you're doing. It's like trying to ride a bike. And at the same time, you're often facing extinction. Like on a regular basis, you know, you really don't know if you're going to make it. And so emotionally, that can be pretty challenging because, you know, you're in this gray scenario and you are responsible for a lot of people, your employees, your investors, and you just don't know if you're going to make it. And so being able to kind of navigate that is challenging. At the same time, it's also super exciting. You have control of your destiny. When you succeed, it's extremely rewarding, as you have, you know, because you've beaten the odds. And so there's nothing I would rather do, but I do think it's one of the hardest things that you can do, which is to do these startups.
What do you think the future of digital media is, or media generally?
Well, I think what you're starting to see is this consolidation between a lot of these players. And I think you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see a lot of companies go public or try to go public via the SPAC market. You've seen over the last couple of years, you know, the really good media companies have survived. Some unfortunately have gone away. And I think with this consolidation, I think you're going to see some strength. So I'm optimistic about it. The platforms keep emerging. You know, you see podcasts, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, I guess they existed, but look at where they are now.
Anyway, Vinny, I'm sorry it took 3.5 years to have you on the show. You know, in fairness, I have asked you before and you declined because you're more shy than people realize, but it's been wonderful. It's been great. You know, I often say to people, if you can work with people who are your friends, which I always have or tried to, there's nothing better than that. And I was kind of wrong. The only thing better than that is working with your family. Oh, if you get along like we do. So thanks. Keep in touch.
You keep in touch. And thanks. I'm going to say,
and I love
say
you,
thanks
bro.
Too. Yeah, I love you too, man. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guest, Andrew Ross Sorkin.
If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. Or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to staytuned@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe Studios. Your host is Preet Bharara. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Jennifer Korn, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.